Friends, Romans, countrymen, backed by popular demand, I bring you tidings from the front lines in Gaul, where the ostentatious Gaius Julius Caesar is engaged in war in your good name. Now, I know what you say, people of Rome. I know what you say. Recent dispatches have been slightly Caesar-light. But don't worry, the wait will be worth it. Today we will hear about the endeavors of Sabinus and Publius Crassus the Younger, which will make us appreciate our time spent with Caesar all the more. These are the words of Caesar as conveyed by Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. During these events in the land of the Veneti, Quintus Tiberius Sabinus, with the force received from Caesar,
reached the borders of the Veneli. Their chief, Viridovix, good asterisk name there, held the supreme command of all the revolted states, from which he had raised an army, and large levies besides. So we'll leave that there, and just a quick positioning us with a geography lesson. Rhiannon, where are we here?
So we're quite close by to where we were with the Veneti.
Mm.
So
we're two letters close by.
Yeah. With the Veneti, we were sort of in Normandy, way out west.
Mm.
Now we've just moved a little bit northeast and in modern Brittany.
Okay.
So the bit of France that sticks out towards Britain.
And what we'll be hearing for the rest of the book was foreshadowed earlier in book three, I noticed, because in chapter 11, Caesar told us this person went over here and dealt with these people,
mm-hmm.
and this person went over here. So now we're getting a fleshing out of that passage.
Yeah, so that was set up, and we were told Sabinus was dispatched with three legions to the territory of the Veneli, and this is the outcome of that.
You can say the other two tribe names there. Okay. Come on.
He was dispatched with three legions to the territory of the Veneli, the Curio Solites, and the Lexovii,
yes.
to keep that force away from the rest. So I guess that Caesar's like the puppet master, that he has got the Veneti dealt with in the far west. Now he needs to make sure that there's no contact between them and various other Gauls and these three groups. So he sent Sabinus to take care of them.
Yes. And the force that Sabinus goes up against sounds like it's quite formidable, that this guy that he's encountered, Viridovix, good asterisk name, is quite good at raising some troops.
Yeah. There's the kind of overall theme that the Gauls are fragmented. There's lots of infighting and this helps the Romans. But when they can get their forces together, which is what Caesar's trying to prevent in this book, they can put some kind of common stand against the Romans. So that's when they're at their most dangerous. And often it is that they are congregating around a charismatic leader.
Yes. So Caesar's tactic is literally divide and conquer.
Absolutely.
Keep them apart, keep them fighting amongst themselves. And when that doesn't happen, conquering becomes very hard.
It does, but the Romans are up to it, of course, at least in Caesar's narrative.
So we're told about some of the tribes that he gets together.
Yeah, so in the last few days, the Aulerci, Eburovices, and the Lexovii, after putting their senate to death because they refused to approve the war, closed their gates and joined Viridovix. So there must have been negotiation and secret negotiation at that going on that Caesar doesn't tell us about, because basically rebel factions from these three sets of people have got rid of their leaders and gone off to join Viridovix.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really quite dramatic, and it's dealt with in quite an offhand way.
Yeah.
And I have seen some commentators who want to translate the word senatus here, which regularly means senate, as just the older men. I think they kind of balk at the idea that people would kill off their senate. And of course, the Gauls don't have a senate as such. That's using terminology from a Roman context. But I think Caesar does mean their magistrates or their people in charge or their counselors, whatever you want to call them, have been got rid of. And it is meant to shock us, albeit that it's said very quickly in about three words in Latin.
But this works in Viridovix's favor, I suppose, because he gets more allies to his cause.
Absolutely, yeah. He's got a whole set of peoples together now.
It says, great host of desperados and brigands. Okay, I do want to know how a Spanish word managed to sneak into this passage here, desperados.
Yeah, so they are a multitudo, which means a great host.
Yeah.
From everywhere in Gaul, and they're a great host of the Perditorum Hominum, which literally means lost men.
Okay.
So kind of lost in terms of their morals.
Yeah.
Or maybe their place in society. And latronum, which means robbers.
Okay.
Low-down scum criminals. The desperado seems to be being used for perditorum, which I think, I mean, desperados literally means losing hope. So, yeah, it's a good translation.
Great hosts of desperados and brigands have gathered, whom the hope of plunder and the passion of war seduced from the daily toll of agriculture.
Yeah, he's very moralistic here, isn't he? It's easier to get wealth by just stealing it from people rather than doing your daily working away at the fields. Very little self-reflection going on the part of the Roman writer here because, of course, he's going to make a huge amount of money from, or already has, from invading Gaul. But when other people do it, apparently.
Viravidix has essentially gone, and see if you catch this reference. Take this down, Rhiannon. I want rustlers, cutthroats, murderers, bounty hunters, desperados, mugs, thugs, pugs, nitwits, halfwits, dimwits, vipers, snipers, con men, Indian agents, Mexican bandits, muggers, buggerers, bushwhackers, hornswogglers, horse thieves, bull dykes, train robbers, bank robbers, ass kickers, shit kickers, and Methodists.
I have no idea what that is. Where the hell is that from?
Blazing Saddles.
I haven't seen it for a very long time.
Well, it worked in Blazing Saddles. So meanwhile, while this force is being gathered, the Romans, Sabinus, confines himself to camp. I find all of his actions in this very strange.
Yeah, we're still in chapter 17. We haven't got very far so far. But there is this potential picture of Sabinus built up, and the word is mentioned a couple of times, which looks quite cowardly. The word timor is mentioned a couple of times, which means fear, that he's enclosing himself in and kind of barricading against the Gauls rather than setting out some kind of attack or even a defensive strategy against them. Because Viridivix, as we're told, encamps 2 miles away, and Sabinus is just enclosing himself. It looks like he's setting himself up for a siege, which is not a good look. Viridivix taunts the Romans for this, and as Caesar tells us, leads his forces out daily to say, you know, I'm up for a fight. At last, says Caesar, Sabinus not only incurred the contempt of the enemy, but was assailed by occasional reproaches even of the Roman troops. So the Romans themselves feel that he's acting in a cowardly way. Indeed, this is still Caesar in chapter 17. Indeed, he created so strong an impression of cowardice, that's the word timor, fear, that at length the enemy ventured to come up to the rampart of the camp. So his actions are encouraging them to become ever more confident that Viridivix and his forces are coming closer and closer and closer, more and more dangerous. And the Romans themselves think this is very poor tactics on the part of Sabinus.
So is this being set up as almost a cautionary tale? You did not do these sort of tactics because it just lets the enemy have the upper hand?
Well, it sort of is. At the same time, we get a little bit of insight into the thought processes of Sabinus, fed to us, of course, via Caesar, that he thinks it's improper to engage with a large force of Gauls with the commander being away, the one who holds supreme command.
That sounds like a cop-out.
Yeah, this whole chapter is quite balanced with those phrases. That at the beginning of the chapter, Viridivix is the one who, in Latin, summum imperi tenerit, so he holds the supreme point of power. And then at the end, the reason Sabinus isn't attacking is because the one who holds supreme power isn't there. It's exactly the same phrase being used of Viridivix and Caesar. And indeed, it does make us think maybe that Sabinus is acting in a cowardly way and that things go wrong when Caesar's not there. I think we're actually being led into a false impression here deliberately by Caesar. There's a kind of narrative trap going on because Sabinus is going to come good.
So he chooses an unnamed but cunning...
Yeah, Calidus. Calidus means cunning or clever. A Gallic auxiliary, so someone who's with the Roman troops but actually is a Gaul, and sends him to the enemy, to the Gauls, promising him great rewards, who basically lies to them and says that Caesar himself is in trouble and Sabinus and his men will be leaving during the night in order to support Caesar against the Veneti. So this is definitely a deceit. They now think that this unnamed cunning Gaul is a spy, and he is a spy, but he's a spy for the Romans, not for the Gauls.
Yes.
Yeah. So they think they have inside information, but it's false information.
And it also plays into the fact that the Gauls could reasonably think that Sabinus is so intimidated by the Gauls that he's running away, and this is just an excuse. But regardless, the Romans are going to be leaving soon, so they've got to press the advantage while they still have it.
Yes, they have to act at night and they have to act quickly, and maybe they won't think it through properly. It's clever in two ways, because it confirms the idea that Sabinus is afraid of the battle, which has been built up either deliberately or not, and it bolsters the Gauls' hopes that their allies, the Veneti, are likely to defeat Caesar. So they all shout to attack the Roman camp. Quite often Caesar will make the Gauls look a bit like an unruly mob, and this is one of those places, rather than a commander making a rational decision. They all go, oh, let's attack, and that kind of carries the day. This is not a good way to make a decision in war. And Caesar actually tells us, and this time he's giving us the thought processes of the Gauls themselves, they would not suffer Viridivix and the rest of the leaders to leave the council until they had their permission to take up arms and press on to the camp. So the soldiers themselves make that decision. This is the ordinary men making the decision rather than the commanders. They're pushing the commanders into something that maybe they would have put more thought into.
So there's a big air of overconfidence here as they approach the ramparts.
Yeah, absolutely the impression that Caesar is giving us.
Mm.
And they're now overly confident because Caesar says, and for those of you who know Latin, there's a lot of use of the subjunctive here, they're acting as though victory were assured. So they're acting on the basis of something that's still in doubt. They think they're going to have a successful achievement, as he puts it, and it shouldn't be lost. So the Gauls just march on the camp.
So we're told something about their tactics here that the Gauls use to attack the Roman camp, and that is that they collect sticks and some brushwood and they fill up the trenches of the Romans. So the Romans have put a trench around their camp with a palisade of some sort. You put a lot of sticks down and you're essentially just filling it up so you can cross it and get straight at the walls.
Yeah, so they're very quickly dealing with the Roman defences.
Mm.
So we get a lot of build-up here. Then the actual battle is dealt with very quickly, which is interesting that Caesar's not really as interested in that. He's interested in the thought processes of each side.
He possibly would have been more interested if he was there.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
But I think there's also the idea that once they get into conflict, the Romans deal with it very efficiently. Mm-hmm. The Gauls move in fast, too fast, and they deal with the Veneti very quickly. And the Romans are now, they're so keen to engage because they've been waiting for this and they think their commander's being a coward. So they want to get out there, according to Caesar. The Veneti really haven't thought it out and they're carrying too much stuff, too much equipment.
They're in that much of a hurry that they're...
They're also, according to Caesar, tired and inexperienced versus, of course, always the brave and experienced Romans. Are they ever anything else? And Caesar praises his own troops for their knowledge, their scientia, and their bravery, their virtus, their manliness. The camp was on high ground with a gradual slope from the bottom of about a mile, so the Gauls have to run uphill.
Yep.
They arrive out of breath, and there's a sudden sortie to be made from two gates. So they exit from two gates. The order was executed with the advantage of ground, that slope. The enemy were inexperienced and fatigued. The Romans courageous and schooled by previous engagements. So there's the direct quote from Caesar where he compares the two sides. And of course, his troops, the Roman troops, come out better.
So the Gauls turn and run at this point?
Yeah, so there's not really an engagement. They're just terrified when the Romans come out at them. And the Romans slew a great number of them.
There is always a great number slewn.
Slain.
Slain. I'll be editing that out.
As I say, we don't get much context of the battle itself. It's a massacre, yet another one.
Mm.
But it's all about outthinking each other before the battle. And the Romans are also described as impediti, which is burdened down with too much armor and equipment, but they're brave, so it's okay. And they pursue and kill many Veneti. The cavalry clean up the rest.
Mm. So with this victory, Caesar would have been informed at this point, and I take it quite pleased with the outcomes.
Yes, and there's a nice little balance at the end of the section, chapter 19, that Sabinus hears about Caesar's victory over the Veneti, and the same chosen Caesar hears about Sabinus's victory over the Veneti. I wonder if he's playing on the two names there being very similar. So we've got this balanced outcome of victory in both of them. And Caesar gives us this very moralistic ending to that chapter. This kind of sums up his view of the Gauls, that they are eager and ready to start, but they've got no stamina. Their purpose is feeble and in no way steadfast to endure disaster. They're not resourceful. And I think this is one of Caesar's explanations for why the Romans continue to win here, even though, of course, there are times when there are setbacks, is that they'll just keep going at it, according to him.
So, well done, Sabinus. You got there in the end. Now we're told about Publius Crassus. And like Sabinus, who was foreshadowed in chapter 11, this one is also foreshadowed then. Publius Crassus, with 12 cohorts from the legion and a large detachment of cavalry, was ordered to start for Aquitania to prevent the dispatch of auxiliaries from the tribes there into Gaul and the junction of the two great nations.
This is one of those uses of Gaul which he spelled out right at the beginning of book one. Remember where there's two ways of using the word Gaul?
Yeah.
It can mean the whole of what we think of now as France and a bit of Belgium.
Gaul as a whole is divided into three parts.
And one of those parts is also called Gaul.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, that's central Gallia, whereas Aquitania is the very far southwest.
He mentioned the Aquitania in that phrase.
Yeah, and they get less attention than any other part of Gaul.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of this is their moment, really, late in book three.
So is this almost Spain?
Yeah, it's close to Spain.
Yeah.
Indeed, there's a word that's coming up.
Yeah.
That some people think is what they call an Iberian word, or it could be a Gallic word.
Oh, nice. So, yeah, yeah.
Which is an interesting linguistic conundrum. It's not a Roman word anyway. Caesar also primes us to think that there is potential danger here by reminding us of a little bit of Roman history in this region. He tells us this is a place in which he must exercise no common care. In other words, he's reminding the reader of a previous Roman defeat back in 78 BCE, which is a very complicated situation and the fallout from the civil war between Sulla and Marius, that one of the followers of Marius, called Sertorius, had moved west and was just continued to sort of cause trouble there. So this was technically a civil war battle. One of Sertorius's followers, called Hertuleus, along with some Aquitanian forces, carried out a defeat of Roman forces. All right, so this is, for us, a slightly obscure event, but something that Caesar invokes here to show that the Aquitanians are no mean forces as well, or at least historically they've been a challenge.
Yeah, so to Romans, it was, 30 years earlier, so quite, reasonably recent history. So it would have been a known reference then, which is fair enough. Okay, so Crassus marched his army into the border of the Sotiates, which I assume is a...
They're an Aquitanian people.
An Aquitanian people. Hearing of the approach, the Sotiates collected a large force with cavalry, in which lay their chief strength, and attacked our column on the march. So didn't even wait for a fort to be set up or anything. No camp, no nothing. Attack them while they're marching.
So the Roman cavalry pursues them, but then they are ambushed. The infantry attacked our scattered horsemen and renewed the fight.
So it sounds very impulsive on both sides and opportunistic.
Well, the Romans have to react to this impulsive, and yeah, you're right, opportunistic. An ambush is always slightly sneaky, but also, of course, you catch people off guard. Now we get this justification in chapter 21 as to why the Sotiates attacked so quickly. So again, a bit about their mindset here. They felt that upon their own courage depended the safety of all Aquitania. So there is a kind of, they're doing this potentially for a noble cause. The Romans were eager to have it seen what they could accomplish under a young leader, Crassus, of course, without the commander-in-chief and the rest of the legions. Crassus is kind of being built up. He's young, but his troops want to please him. They want to make him look good.
It's very different from what Sabinus just did a few chapters beforehand.
Yeah, and where his troops were accusing him of cowardice. There's a lot more confidence in the leader here.
So in this instance, the Roman forces were victorious, but straight away Crassus decides to push on and attack a stronghold. And to me, the translation, the explanation of the Gaulish tactics here aren't terribly clear as to what's going on.
Well, there's a siege going on, all right? So Caesar tells us in chapter 21, when they offered a brave resistance, actually calling the Gauls brave there, he brought up mantlets and towers. So these mantlets are movable huts made of wood and with some wicker over them, maybe covered with hides to protect them from fire. They protect the soldiers while they're moving in, mount hide behind, so a defensive position. This is all siege technology, which the Romans are very good at. What the Sotiates do in opposition to this is they, the translation says, pushed mines as far as the ramp and the mantlets. And in mining, the Aquitani are by far the most experienced of men because in many localities among them, there are copper mines and diggings. All right, so you didn't think the translation was very clear here.
Are they digging to undermine the mantlets?
There are different interpretations of this. Certainly they dig tunnels underneath the Roman ramp, or the agger, the mound as it's called, part of the defensive earthwork. One of the commentaries says this is so it collapses in. I guess one possible interpretation is so that they can get out and fight. But actually, I think maybe having the Roman siege technology be destroyed by it is a good interpretation. Caesar doesn't explicitly tell us. They're literally undermining the siege works.
See, I always thought that these sieges sounded like they would be over too quickly for such a slow process. It takes time to dig ground out from under
the people. Well, sieges could last a very long time. Caesar's not specific here. He makes it sound like this is not a long process, and I don't think it's one of those ones that lasts weeks and months, or he would tell us.
Yeah.
But I think that's why he's stressing that they're very skilled here. Yeah. They can do this quickly. They know how to dig quickly in order to destroy these works.
Mm.
So that's how I'd interpret it. But we're not given a lot of detail, it's true.
Mm-hmm. So despite this tactic to undermine the siege works, this isn't something that goes to the Gauls' advantage.
No. So Caesar builds them up as very skilled in this way. So potentially a little bit of tension about whether they will manage to overcome the siege. Straight away, he says, when they perceived that by reason of the efficiency of our troops, good troops again, no advantage was to be gained by these expedients. In other words, the undermining of the siege works. They sent deputies to Crassus and besought him to accept their surrender.
Mm.
So they give their arms up, they give their weapons up. But while the troops are gathering in the arms, we get a little bit of subterfuge on the part of the Sotiates. We're told that Adiaturnus, the commander-in-chief, or having the highest power, again, that same phrase, took action from another quarter of the town with 600 devotees whom they call vassals. This is an interesting linguistic point. This word is solduri, which is not a Latin word. Soldurius is a Celtic word. We don't know exactly what it means. It seems to mean, there's a note in our Lurb edition saying it means perhaps in duty bound to the chief. This is why the word vassal is used. Seems to be somebody who is committed to sharing the fate of the warriors.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
What Caesar explains it as.
Yeah.
The rule of these men, he says, is that in life they enjoy all the benefits with the comrades to whose friendship they have committed themselves, while if any violent fate befalls their fellows, they endure the same misfortune along with them or take their own lives. So it looks as though they're not frontline troops, but they will come along either to help out or, if they can't, supposed to suicide.
Yeah, I can see why the term devotees is applied there.
Yeah.
But this is like a little aside almost because they are not successful.
No, they attack, but they're driven back and no details there really.
No.
And they receive the same terms of surrender, which suggests to me they're not carrying out what they're meant to do under the terms that Caesar has set up.
And also Crassus is merciful.
He is. I'm quite surprised at this move from a Roman commander because this has been a counterattack after surrender's been asked for and given by the Romans. But they get the same terms of surrender as what he says.
So Crassus now marches his troops to the borders of the Rhiannon.
Vocates and Tarusates.
Thank you.
And we get a little bit of building up Crassus here because the natives are scared of him, as the translation
puts it. Oh, so he's got a reputation now.
Already.
Yeah.
So at this juncture, says Caesar, the natives, alarmed by that information that a town fortified alike by natural position and by the hand of man, so this should have been difficult to take, had been carried within a few days of his arrival. So we do actually know how long the siege lasted began to send deputies about in every direction to conspire together to deliver hostages to each other and to make a ready force. So they need to gather together. But the way it's described sounds, A, like they're scared of Crassus now. Mm-hmm. And B, it just sounds a bit chaotic somehow.
It sounds very rushed.
Yeah, even though it is the standard things you do if you are gathering a force together from different peoples. All right, you give hostages to make sure that none of you will betray the others.
Mm-hmm.
The speed with which it's delivered in the Latin means that it looks like they're really spooked by Crassus and they're sort of reacting rather than thinking it through. But, you know, actually what they do is they send deputies, as it's put here, out to those states of nearer Spain. So they're going further afield. As we've mentioned, Aquitania is very close to Spain or Hispania. And they're trying to get auxiliaries in from over that border.
So now we get a bit of tactic description. So I'll read this quote here. At dawn, he brought out all his force and formed a double line. So this is Crassus. With the auxiliaries massed in the center, then he waited to see what plan the enemy would adopt. So it's very cautious.
It is. And he's not rushing, unlike the Gauls. The Gauls are very confident, but they're also cautious. And they decide to kind of attack something vulnerable to cut off the Romans' food supplies.
Mm.
They have noticed what the Romans have been saying all along, or what Caesar's been saying all along, that food supply is very important.
Yes.
And to attack them when they were encumbered in column by the weight of their packs, so their spirit would be the weaker. Right at the beginning there, we had a good illustration of how Crassus is actually acting. He's having to act from weakness. He's only got a double line.
Mm.
The usual formation is to have three lines of troops, to be at least three lines deep. So you've got one line doing literally the front line fighting and the second line backing them up.
Yeah.
But then you've got a third line in reserve in case that goes wrong. He doesn't have the reserve. He's got to win the first time.
So we're told back in chapter 11 that he's got 12 cohorts. So that's only enough for two lines, is it?
Well, it's only enough for two lines of what he needs here, yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess why he's had to put the auxiliaries in the middle.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, Crassus works out that the Gauls are going for his food supplies. But he encourages his troops by showing them that this means the Gauls are very timid about their attack. They're not attacking face on. He harangued his troops and then, amid general enthusiasm, he pressed on to the enemy's camp. The Roman troops are very eager to fight. Caesar keeps telling us this. They're always keen to fight, even though they must know that they don't have the forces to really carry out this battle as easily as they normally would. So holding them back makes them even more eager, Caesar says. It makes them alacriores.
So Crassus marches his men onto the enemy camp, and once they get there, some of them proceed to fill up the trenches, we are told. Others by many volleys of missiles to clear the defenders from the ramparts and the fortifications, while the auxiliaries, in whom Crassus had no great confidence for actual fighting.
Yeah, ouch. Because the only confidence you have is in the Roman soldiers, okay. not these bits and pieces people, these auxiliaries that you've picked up.
Yeah, but, you know, rub it in. by handling up stones and missiles and carrying sods to make a ramp. Gave the appearance and impression of fighting troops. So at least look like you're contributing guys, but just hand us some rocks.
It's very faint praise.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the enemy, for their part, fought in no irresolute or cowardly fashion.
Yeah, right up front, Caesar has told us that despite the rush to get everything together, they've got a pretty formidable force together.
Mm.
So there's real tension here for Crassus.
And their missiles discharged from a higher level fell to some purpose.
Yeah.
So their aim was true.
Exactly. They're killing Romans is basically what that means. But Crassus notices something.
Crassus's men notice something, and they report back to Crassus.
You're quite right. You're quite right.
Credit where it's due.
Basically, the rear of the enemy's camp is not well defended. Caesar calls the back of their camp the Decumana Porta, the 10th gate, which is inaccurate in a way because this is a Gallic camp, but this is based on the setup of a Roman camp.
Yeah.
Where the reason it's called the 10th gate is that it's the area of the camp where the 10th cohort of a legion would be camped. He's going to attack them via the back door that they have not well defended.
That was a nice nerdy fact there from you.
It was. I like to throw them in with a bit of Latin as well.
Yeah, sure.
and also, of course, it depicts the Gauls as rather sloppy because the implication is the Romans would defend their Decumana Porta. They wouldn't be left in this position.
Yes. So Crassus finds out that that's less defended than it should be, and so he orders an attack from the rear.
Mm-hmm.
They threw down the fortifications and established themselves in the enemy's camp before they could be clearly seen by them or their actions perceived. But when shouting was heard in that quarter, the Romans, with strength renewed, began, as is frequent and usual, where there is hope of victory, to assault them more vigorously.
Yeah, praising the Romans' troops through and through. Not only are they really quick to get there,
yeah,
but also even when there's danger, that just makes them fight harder.
Yes, and this is always the case.
Yep, frequent and usual.
Yeah, yep, frequent
and
usual.
What he expects and what he's seen so many times. So really, Caesar lays on the praise with a trowel here. And even though, I mean, this book is so interesting because Caesar's basically absent for a lot of it. And the commanders get varying degrees of respect, and Crassus gets more than most of them. But the Roman troops always get the most lavish praise.
Yeah. So this has, as is frequent and usual, all fallen apart for the Gauls.
Mm-hmm. So they try and get out.
Yes. And a great many were slew, I'm sure. I shouldn't brush that off. And of 50,000, the number known to have assembled from the Aquitania and the Cantabrian
region, so over in Spain, basically.
Yes. They had left scarce a quarter when they returned to camp late at night.
Yeah, so what, they had about 12,000 left.
35,000 plus people.
Yeah. Commentators aren't happy with this number. They never are in ancient histories. They think it's an exaggeration. And, you know, I've seen some older commentaries that make parallels with more modern battles and say the numbers are just really hard to judge anyway.
Yeah.
But it's of course, to Caesar's advantage to talk about huge numbers of the enemy.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's interesting, but it's terrible interesting that if this was a war fought in modern times, they would try and emphasize how few people were killed. Whereas Caesar goes, nah. You know, slew a great many, scarce a quarter when they returned to the camp at night. It's really great to emphasize just how few of them got away.
Well, I guess you could see it from the other point of view. I mean, I'm not trying to whitewash Caesar at all or the Romans' tactics.
Mm.
But given that it's been set up as very few Romans defeating a great number of Gauls, then this is a huge achievement. So then it looks much more courageous. I think we still do things like that, potentially, at least in relatively recent history.
Yeah.
I mean, you've seen the film Zulu, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so it can be heroic if a very small number of forces manage to defeat or even just stand up against superior force.
Yeah, or, you know, the recent Star Wars movies.
Yeah, that happened.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it's the same kind of discourse, I suppose we could call it, the same setup.
Yeah.
Where if your tactics and your bravery can overcome seemingly insurmountable odds, it's a standard narrative of the little guy. Although to think of the Romans as the little guy is very difficult to see.
In the case of this,
they've managed to withstand that.
In the case of this, Crassus is here with 12 cohorts, I think we said. He could only have two lines of soldiers. The fact that he slew 35,000 Gauls as a result is a great victory, to the extent where it intimidates the rest of the area.
Absolutely. The great outcome for the Romans is not that a load of people are dead quite so much, but it gives them now this stature whereby other people will just surrender to them.
But there is still a suggestion of a threat.
There is. So even though, as Caesar says in chapter 27, the greatest part of Aquitania surrendered to Crassus and the tribes then send them hostages, there's still a suggestion of the threat coming from those who are most distant. Because this, after all, is a long way from where Caesar's been kind of concentrating on northern Gaul, really.
Mm.
And he says a few of the most distant, trusting in the season, do not send hostages. And what he means by that is winter is coming indeed.
Yeah.
So they can just kind of hole up and hope he won't come for them.
Mm. So well done, Crassus. So now we get to chapter 28, the very last chapter in the book. And suddenly we're back with Caesar again because he does have to wrap it all up.
Can't leave himself out of the book.
But it's almost like the entire book has played out. You get the end credits, and then Nick Fury comes in and says...
Not everyone is going to get that reference.
What's going to be happening in book 4, essentially? What threat is being set up?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're told very late in the day that Caesar is now leading troops against the Morini and Menapii. So Caesar goes back up north now, or at least his narrative goes back up north. We've been down with the Aquitani, the Menapii and the Morini are in the northern corner in modern Netherlands and Belgium.
Mm, so pretty far north.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much as far as he's going to go in Gaul. We've kind of had the two extremes here at the second half of book three. And Caesar doesn't think that it's going to be much of a battle, although he's confronted, as he puts it in chapter 28, by tactics quite different from the rest of the Gauls.
Yeah.
And his men make a camp. They're scattered at work and the enemy attacks them, those sneaky Gauls doing their ambush again.
Very opportunistic, yes.
However, the Romans just pick up their weapons, drove the enemy back into the forests, and a considerable number of them were slain, of course.
Yes.
But as the Romans pursued too far in almost impassable places, they lost a few of their own side, so the Roman casualties too. Now, Caesar's response to this is they've run off into the forest, which is impenetrable. He cuts down the forest.
Sure.
Yeah, so just cut through the problem.
Again, it doesn't strike me as a speedy tactic.
They can work pretty fast.
Mm, okay, all right. Almost as fast as the Gauls can mine, apparently.
Yeah. They cut down a lot of those trees, so they've cut down a lot of the Menapii and Morini defences. But the rains come and they're going to have to put off this campaign until the following year and the next book.
So, again, this is foreshadowing. This is a problem here. It's going to have to be dealt with after winter.
He's going to place his winter quarters amongst the people they've just conquered, the Aulerci, the Lexovii, and some other states.
Mm.
And this is really is a build-up book for what's going to come in books. Books four and five are going to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, but this book doesn't end at peace.
No, he doesn't state it exactly at this point because he can't viably do that, yeah, having foreshadowed a coming battle against these peoples.
Mm. Accordingly, after laying waste all the fields of the enemy and burning villages and farm buildings, Caesar brought back his army
and placed it in winter quarters among the... Oh, here we go. The Aulerci, the Lexovii, and the rest of the states which had recently waged war. They now know better. Well, what a cliffhanger. Something tells me that Caesar will be avenging this situation quite soon. If I were you, I would definitely be returning for future dispatches of Caesar's Gallic War. But until then, ave, ave.